Hello and welcome to Cycling Mole, your cycling informant. This is my first ever podcast. I am delighted to say I'm joined by Jay Thompson of Dimension Data. Jay, how are you?
Yeah, very well, and yourself, David? Pretty excited to be part of the first podcast.
Very excited. So a little explanation before we get started. This is a series which is called The Day I... ...and we're going to take a bunch of cyclists, hopefully, and look back at various points throughout their career. With Jay, we're going to do The Day I Reflect on My Professional Career. A really good opportunity for us to look at what Jay's done over the years and kind of go into the mind of a professional cyclist and everything that's kind of going on over a long career. So Jay, let's get straight into it. Obviously born in South Africa, grown up at school, major sports I would imagine would be cricket and rugby. How did you get into cycling?
My father was always an enthusiast that rode bikes, and then my brother started riding a bit on the track and doing a little bit on the side, and I was always interested in watching the Tour de France because we used to get it live in South Africa. So I used to go home from school, watch the Tour de France, and I used to always think it was weird watching guys ride around in Lycra, but okay, these ballerinas. I used to always be a rugby player, so you know, you can imagine what I thought. Yeah, and then one day my brother twisted my arm and got me to get on a bike, and I went with him, and yeah, from there, all his history, I fell in love with the sport there and then.
So what age do you reckon you were when you kind of really got the cycling bug?
Oh, when I really got it, I was probably 18, turning 19.
And when did you seriously start to consider and think about cycling as a job?
Wow, maybe 2007, 2006, 2007 is when I thought, okay, this is possible that I could maybe make money out of this.
In those days, obviously, South African cycling, you know, it wasn't huge. How hard was it to kind of make a breakthrough back in like 06, 07?
Yeah, it was difficult because we didn't really have any teams. We had Barloworld at the time then. So, you know, that was always an inspiration for all of us that were starting up, you know, to get going. And I rode for Barloworld's feeder team called Konica Minolta in 2007. As you say, you know, Cycling South Africa wasn't really set up that we had these programs in Europe or anything like that. So, you know, we kind of had to do it ourselves, do little stints here and there, and did a little bit in Belgium, raced there, broke my collarbone, raced some more, did a tour of Japan that year. Then, yeah, 2008 and 2009 kind of landed back up in the African scene, did tour of Britain, tour of Ireland both years, and then went and raced in the US with Team Dimension Data, originally known as MTN Energy back then. We raced the Super Week, 20 races or whatever it was in 20 days in a row kind of thing. It was 3 weeks of racing, so, you know, just kind of crit style racing. Longest day was 160Ks, and landed up winning a few races there against the Fly V boys, and yeah, and that kind of got me my foot in the door. So a few years after, really, I planned on thinking and making a career out of it. It took me a while to actually leave the South African scene.
What did your family say when you told them, you know, I want to be a professional cyclist?
Yeah, of course, Dad was super excited because, you know, he was always a bike rider when he was younger and won the South African champs and always raced on the track. So I think he always hoped that one of his boys would become a professional cyclist, and you know, when I said I was going to try and do it, you know, they were 100% behind me.
You mentioned there you moved over to America, you rode for Bissell, you rode for United Healthcare. What was it like moving away from home at a relatively young age?
Oh, look, I moved out of the house when I was 19. I was always a kind of a guy that always wanted to be sustainable, you know, look after myself. So, you know, I kind of lived already in my own place already when I was 19, working in a bike shop, earning nothing, literally enough just to pay for rent and then had dinner every night at mom. So when you're going to go to America, you have some things like Skype and you have WhatsApp calls and all those things. So it really wasn't super difficult for me to be there. You know, you just had to time it right with the time zones.
You mentioned there, like the jobs and stuff. In those early days when you were riding back home, you know, how did you fund yourself?
Yeah, as I say, I used to wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning, get on the bike, go training till 9 o'clock, and then go work in a bike shop from 9 until 5. You know, trying to make some money. The guy used to help pay for, you know, race entry fees or traveling to races. But then from 2006, I kind of always had sponsors, so it always did help that I had, you know, little teams that I rode for that could always pay for all those things. So the bike shop was just for extra money.
2013, enormous year, African Cycling, MTN Quebeca, stepped up to Pro Conti level. You moved back to the team, well, kind of a new team, but you know, you've mentioned before you rode for Quebeca. Just how big a kind of moment was that for South African Cycling, for yourself, that first big team?
Yeah, that was massive. You know, we always had Barloworld, but you know, this was something else. This was something different. You know, Barloworld was kind of more a South African sponsor, but more run by the Italians and kind of through Britain. So, you know, this was actually run by a South African, developed everything done by Douglas. So it was massive. I think it was one of the biggest steps that African cycling needed. And I think you can definitely see by the way, yeah, Trier and Rwanda and all of those guys are starting to race their bikes. They start to believe, okay, well, if the South Africans can do it, why can't we? You know, I think for African cycling, what Team Dimension Data does is incredible.
2013, also a huge year for the team. I mean, you were invited to Milan San Remo. Most people thought you were just there to probably make up the numbers. And then all of a sudden, Gerald Chierlich pops up with a win, which was still one of those moments. You watch it back, the hair stands on end. It was a tremendous moment, I'm sure, for the team. What was that day like? You know, at the beginning, did you dream that Chierlich was going to win?
Definitely. You know what? I trained with Chierlich a lot in the off season because I was preparing for the Nationals, and we trained really hard, and he was so motivated to be good in Torino and San Remo. So you kind of knew he would do something, but to win, I think no one believed it, only him. I think only he really believed that he could win. You know, when we had the little break over the Torquino and went to the other side and he was doing push-ups in the back of the bus and I had all my clothes on, this little African boy, I realized, okay, this is the big boy stuff and this guy's got something. When I was frozen to death and stopped the bike race, hearing on the radio him winning was an incredible feeling to be part of. It's still one of the moments that put this team on the map and helped it build a few more steps.
You mentioned there that it was an iconic day, the weather, the bus trip. I mean, is it one of those races where you just think, yeah, this is big boy cycling?
I think that just showed, like, got to be in the most iconic Milan-San Remo ever with the snow. It definitely wasn't the coldest. I think the next year was worse. I think from temperature-wise, from feeling, we never had a break. But yeah, 2013, that was a year that everybody will remember because of the break, a little 1 hour bus trip and sit at the start there thinking it was going to get cancelled, saying it was cancelled, then starting again, and oh, it was a fun day.
Looking at some particular races, some kind of standout moments. 2014, you rode your first Grand Tour, you went to the Vuelta. What was that experience like, that three-week experience?
We rode the Volta Portugal the year before, and that was incredibly hard. Then I went to the Volta, and that was even harder, and I just didn't understand how fast people could go uphill. But then you realise, you know, there's guys that can ride Grand Tours, there's guys that can win Grand Tours, and I wasn't one of them that was going to win Grand Tours.
Looking back on it, a lot of people talk about like the bounce you get from your first Grand Tour, the increase in stamina. Did you notice anything like the next season?
Yeah, for sure you do. You definitely find that you get like a little bit more depth. You know, you have another gear in your engine. Of course, I would love to have seen what it would have done to me when I was younger. You know, if you were 25 and do that first one. I did my first one when I was 27 or 28. So, you know, you're really getting on legs. But, you know, I definitely think it did put me in good steadfastness to now. You know, every Grand Tour I've done, I've always felt that, always feel better afterwards. You know, obviously you're fatigued after the race itself, but once the fatigue gets away and you recover properly, you definitely can feel that you've got another engine.
2018, this season, you do the big one. You get your first Tour de France. How crazy is it?
I don't think you could ever explain to anybody that hasn't actually raced a bike at the Tour de France how crazy it really is. You know, you can tell people it's on a different level. And you can try and explain it. It's almost like a football match. It's just like you're in a stadium every single day. There's people screaming, you know, the Giro's from the sense of that how many people are watching is probably about the same, but the atmosphere at the Tour de France is just literally like football. I think if you can put it to any other sport, you know, there's angry fans, there's happy fans, there's the fans that has his favorite, her favorite. that dislike this one, dislike this one, you know, and then you've got the neutral friends that are just screaming for everybody. So, you know, it's like where you go to the other Grand Tours, people are a lot more neutral, you know, they just, of course, they've got their favorites, but they're a lot more neutral. They're not negative, where the Tour de France is, there's a little bit more anger in the crowd sometimes, I could say.
Can you enjoy it? Obviously, you're being tested to the end of your physical capabilities. Can you kind of stand back a little bit and enjoy those 3 weeks?
I tried as much as I could, and I think I did. You know, for me, I loved every second of riding the Tour de France. So, you know, hopefully one day I still get a chance to go back. You know, but to me, it was the highlight of my career so far. You know, it was really an incredible moment to be there, just to experience it. I've ridden all 3 Grand Tours now, so, you know, it's definitely something that was worth the suffering and the heartache and the, you know, everything that you go through, the years that you don't go and you miss, and, you know, the disappointments and the downs and the ups and the injuries and everything that you go through till you ride the race that you've always wanted to. You know, every bike rider wants to do the Tour de France. You don't start bike riding and say, you know, I don't want to do the Tour de France. Of course, if I'd never done it, then I would never done it and said, okay, you know, it wouldn't have made me a different person than who I am today. But yeah, of course, it's fulfilling of having done it once. Now it's like the first time you have a really good coffee. You have to have more.
What was the feeling like on the Champs-Élysées? You finished it, because that's the other thing. I suppose the worry is you go there, it's a hard race. You've got these insane short stages. Lots of riders climbed off the bike. What was the feeling like when you completed it?
Yeah, super emotional. You know, riding up the backside of up to Triumph before you actually come onto the Champs-Élysées, I had goosebumps already, and I hadn't even been on there yet. So your first time, I can imagine it's like that every time when you ride on there, the noise, and then you feel the tension, everybody getting ready for the big showdown for the sprinters. It's it's unbelievable, the feeling that you have when you ride on there for the first time. And, you know, even the last lap, I still had goosebumps going around thinking, wow, you know, I've made it. Got to the end, yeah. It's always nice to finish a Grand Tour. It's always nice to finish any bike race, but, you know, to finish the Tour de France, especially your first one, definitely bucket list stuff.
Was there a worry? I remember one stage, Cavendish, I think, was sick. You were back with him for quite some time. You were considerably far behind the race. Was there ever a kind of small worry in your brain thinking, I'm going to have to stay with Cav? Is there a kind of worry there?
You know, when Cav is such a professional and he's such a champion, in a way I was a little bit nervous, of course. You know, it's my first Grand Tour. I didn't want to go home because it was out of my hands. Because I knew he was a champion, we spoke about it, and he said to me, look, if I believe that you're not going to make it, I'm going to tell you to leave me. If I believe I'm not going to make it. And that's what happened. You know, myself and Julian were with him, and eventually he just said, guys, just leave me. I said, I'm not going to make it. I can't go faster than I'm going now. I don't want you to go home because I can't go fast enough. You know, so, you know, for me, that gave me so much more, you know, I had so much respect for the guy already. And that gave me even more, you know, he could have just said to us, no, you have to stay with me till the end. And we missed time cut. That's the way it is. But, you know, a true champion shows, you know, even in defeat, he says, okay. He still shows that he's a champion in saying, okay, leave me. I'll do this by myself. And, you know, you stay in the race. The team needs you. Yeah, of course, in the back of my mind, I thought, this is going to be close. You know, luckily I wasn't going too bad and I could still go uphill quite fast because, yeah, I just hung on the back of event. I was hanging on with Julian and he was just going full gas on the climbs. And I just said to him, look, you just keep going your speed. If I drop from you, I'll catch you. And I literally sat 10 to 20 meters behind him sometimes, 50 meters behind him, and then back on his wheel because it was like I was going through, you know, we had to close 10 minutes to the Gruppetto. It wasn't going to be an easy feat. So, you know, he climbs a lot better than I do. So I had to just suffer and think about his wheel the whole time. And, you know, you go through there and you think to yourself, just don't let the gap get bigger than 20 or 30 meters, because if it does, then you give up. You know, so it was kind of, I used him as my little carrot like a donkey. And yeah, we caught the Gruppetto before the final climb and suffered up the final climb to the finish, and it was okay. But the next day I paid for that effort, I can tell you that.
making it home within time, you explained there the difficulty. Does it almost feel like a kind of victory, that idea of we made it, we survived?
Of course, you know, the next day up to US, I can tell you, this was a... you know, when you see so many big names that have already stepped off the bike, and then getting dropped early on the cold and muddy lane, having a bad day and not feeling good at all, you know, even on the downhill before the start, and I was like, oh, I'm in trouble today, you know. For sure, when I got to the top of Alpe d'Huez and made the time cut, I was, that was a big victory. That was a, I made that one, Now I should be able to get to the finish.
What about Paris-Roubaix? So obviously one of the most iconic races in the world, 2015 outside time limit, 2016, I think you arrived in the last three riders. 2017, you make the time limit by, I'm going to say it was about 20 seconds.
Yeah, I think it was 17 if I remember the calculation correct. And I rode the last 100 Ks by myself.
And then 2018, this year, you had a day in the break, ruined by mechanical. We've seen the pictures of you before from this year with the kind of the cuts on your hands. I mean, really kind of iconic photographs. Talk about 2017. You know, you mentioned it there. You're doing the last 100K by yourself. I think you once told me you were on, was it Cafodd de Labre when you saw Van Avermaet win?
Yeah. So obviously, you know, as you say, 2015, I was there, missed the time limit by also 2 or 3 minutes. And I was riding with one guy from Astana. We rode from Orenburg. So I punched it in Orenburg, had to ride to the end. Then I looked behind me and there was no one. Looked in front of me and there was no one. So I carried on going. And eventually I caught this turquoise little man. I thought it was just some random person, but actually, yeah, it was a bike rider. And the two of us, I was like, look, it's my first Roubaix, I want to finish, so I'm going to go to the end. And the kind of the two of us just, he was like, okay, you know, also thinking, I've got no other choice, I have to follow this idiot. So yeah, the two of us rode to the finish and we missed time cut, I think, only by a minute or two. So that was disappointing. And then the next year I went again, 16. I think I crashed 3 times, punched it twice, and then landed up by myself again. Caught a group, and we somehow made it to be in the time limit, but I was also last or second last, somewhere around there. Then 17 crashes, punches. Scott Thwaites, I think, crashed 3 times. I brought him back. Then Edvald punched, crashed twice. I brought him back. And then I blew, and then I crashed. And then there was Michael Hepburn's crash on Forest of Orenburg, and I was with there, and my head fell off. I couldn't pedal the bike. I kind of rode to the end of Orenburg and thought I was going to get off because of, you know, I just saw so much blood, and my mind was completely mush. Then by the time I got to the next sector, I was like, okay, well, I've got no really choice here. The broom wagon's nowhere to be seen. All the guys that the team had on the side of the road are gone. So I was like, okay, well, let me just keep plodding along and then see what happens. And yeah, so obviously from Orenburg to the finish is just under 100 Ks, I think, 98 Ks or something like that. I carried on riding for myself and got to each sector and there was still a group of people cheering you on. So you kind of get a little bit more motivation. Then came to Cafodd de Labre. There was a massive screen at the end there. And I saw Van Avermaet win, and I did the math in my head, and I said 5%, this is going to be close. I had to do the last 15Ks as hard as I could go at that point of the time, but yeah, was happy to make the time cut by the thinnest of margins after a day that was, if you speak to everybody, Roubaix, that everybody has a crazy day, something happens that no one else sees, or, you know, when you're in the cars half the time of the day, it's an honor just to get to the velodrome. So disappointed about this year that, you know, I had a mechanical ruin, the breakaway. I'm not saying that I would have done a Sylvain Dillier, but it would have been nice to see how long far my legs would have been able to take me without that.
You've done something that a lot of riders dream of, most kind of don't. You've ridden all 5 monuments. Starting out in the sport, you know, you're saying there you come home from school, South Africa, and watching the TV, watching the tour. Just, I mean, it's quite a massive achievement, no?
Yeah, of course. You know, I always say to my dad, and I say to my wife too, it's like, if my career stops tomorrow, it's fulfilled. If I decide to just say, okay, I've had enough of the suffering and the freezing cold and rain and in the gutters and just want to stop, I'd be a happy man. You know, I would never say, what if. I wouldn't be one of these guys sitting at the bar and saying, oh, if only this went right, or I only did that, you know. So for me, it's, and that was before I did the Tour de France. So, you know, now I've done that, so I could really say that, honestly, I've done the biggest race in every single continent bar Australia. I've raced in Australia, but I haven't done Down Under. That's the only biggest race I haven't done. But otherwise, I've done the biggest race on every continent in every, pretty much in every country in Europe. And I've done the biggest races around the world. And I've, as you say, the five monuments, I've done three Grand Tours. You know, I've raced in Argentina, I've done California, I've raced Tour de Beauce in Canada. You know, I've raced Tour of Wellington when it used to be on in New Zealand. I've raced Malaysia, I've raced both the tours of China, I've done the Gongxing Tour of China, I've done races all over Africa, Morocco, Rwanda, Cameroon, Senegal, where else have I been? I think somebody sent me a thing the other day that I've raced in 37 different countries, the only person in the world tour that's done that.
I mean, that leads on to something kind of slightly different. What is the best thing about being a cyclist? You know, you've talked there, you've travelled, I'm sure you've travelled more of the world than you would have thought of as a kid. What is the kind of the best things about, you know, your job and the opportunities it gives you?
Yeah, of course, the places we get to see, you know. Never in a million years would I have dreamed and been able to afford to have done all the places I've seen. And, you know, the people you get to meet along the way and friendships you make and see come and go. And, yeah, it's, cycling has it all for you. And I think it's different to any other sport because, yeah, in every other sport you kind of stuck to a stadium. The stadium is the country that you see on the bike. So, you know, you get to see the world. You get to live through triumph, defeat, you know, as a team. You get to see guys win biggest races. You get to win races. It's, you know, that's what bike riding is all about, is to be able to just experience it all and have an experience that you can walk away with and say, well, that was something different. That was something that no money, no school, no nothing in life can bring you, what you get as a bike rider.
Okay, moving away from racing, I want to talk a little bit about training. How do you stay motivated? Like, I was on your Strava today. You were out for about 4 hours in the winter. You know, what keeps you going?
I don't know. It's weird. It's the motivation. You've got this bug in you that you have to be better and you have to be stronger. And I know, okay, today I had to do 4 hours, and it's most of the time it was sitting at -2. It was misty. It was cold. It was, you know, I'd rather be inside my house instead of in front of the fire with the last glass of red wine, of course. But knowing that doing those rides like today, you know, you're becoming a little bit harder, you're becoming a little bit stronger, you're becoming something more, the fire gets more lit inside you when you accomplish what you had to do in training when you have a bad day. And the other day I went training and it was pouring with rain and it was freezing cold, and I thought to myself, what am I doing? And then I thought, you know what? If I get to go to the Giro this year in 2019 and I have to ride in the snow up Stelvio or the Gavia or whatever, I have to be prepared for that. So, you know, to be able to do that, or be in the classics and it's freezing cold and Valgren says I need to ride the front because he's going to win today, I can't say no, but sorry, I'm cold. I need to do it. So, you know, that's what gives me the motivation to train in the cold. And, you know, it's easy to get on a plane and go somewhere south where it's warm. But to still do the same training, to still have, you know, I did 35,000 kilometers last year on the bike. You have to be able to do it. You have to be able to suffer through the cold to be able to enjoy the warm, maybe. I've almost become, you know, from an African boy where I've just been able to ride in warm weather, I can ride now in 0 degrees with no gloves on. You know, after zero, then it's like, okay, that hurts now. Not hard enough yet. I need to harden up a little bit more. But it's definitely the motivation to go training is to see the success of the team and obviously my own success. You know, I'm not a guy that's winning bike races every day, but when I can be there in the final to help somebody win a bike race, it's as in fulfilling for me as it is for them. You know, and obviously, of course, that day when my chance comes, I have to be ready to be able to take it.
How do you entertain yourself when you're training? Are you listening to music? Are you, you know, what do you do?
No, I've got a good friend inside my head. I hate listening, to be honest. I even ride the rollers without music, so I hate listening to music while I'm riding, because I don't know, just I kind of just switch my brain off and off I go. I think about things that I'm going to do in the afternoon, or I think about, oh, what am I going to do with my daughter today? Oh, okay, we're going to IKEA this afternoon. I think about the intervals I have to do. I think about bike races. I think about being successful in bike races. I kind of just run through those motions. That's how I keep myself sane from not going crazy. Yeah, but the best thing I do is try and switch the brain off and just pedal along, especially on the easier days where you don't have to think about doing intervals or anything. You're just riding. Just switch the brain off and the next thing you know is 3 hours have gone by.
You mentioned there you've got a daughter. Being a dad, how did that change things for you in terms of riding the bike?
It definitely becomes a little bit more difficult because it's harder to leave home. Definitely a lot harder to leave. But in another sense, you become more motivated to be better for them. You know, of course, the better, more successful I am, the better life I can give them. So, you know, you kind of have a drive to be successful in a different way, you know. But it does make it much more difficult. You know, the last 3 years, leaving your daughter at home and your wife at home, it's not so easy. You know, I like being at home, you know. So when you've gone for long periods, you know, that's also maybe why I don't go away in the winter. It's because I want to be home. I want to be as close as I can to them. And if that means I have to ride in the morning on the rollers, in the afternoon I have to go ride in the snow, I do it because I know I'm doing it for them. And I'm doing it so I can be happy. It's not to make them happy. I'm sure they would be happy not to have Dada around all the time.
Talking of contracts and kind of the fragile world of cycling, you know, it's a kind of year-to-year, if you're lucky, 2-year to 2-year sort of existence. How nervous is it, you know, you're in a contract year, you know, does it kind of weigh on your mind at all?
Yeah, of course. You know, when you're a bike rider, you're always thinking about it, because especially if it starts out bad and you're having a bad year, the end of the season comes quite fast. You know, a year sounds long, but a year in a bike rider, it goes really fast. You know, you train really hard now and the classics come, you crash in the first classics, break your wrist, the whole classics is gone. So that means everything you trained in the off season is pretty much in the toilet just because of a crash in the beginning of the classics, or you have a bad classics campaign. It's, you know, where do you recover that? You know, if you don't go to the Tour de France because now you've had a bad classics, they don't take you to the Tour, you kind of lose out there. So then you have to try and pick it up for the end of the season. So then obviously you have this massive stress in the middle of the year saying, okay, I need to get some sort of results, make them want me, you know, want them to keep you on the team. And so, of course, every bike rider has it. You know, the big guys have it with winning bike races. The small us workers, we have it in doing a good job.
And is this your contract year?
Yeah. No, this contract year for me, yeah.
I'm not wanting to retire you now at all. You're only 32. But life after cycling, you know, you're 32. You've maybe got, we don't know, 2 years, 6 years. Have you thought about life after cycling and what that might look like for you?
Yeah, of course, you know, everybody thinks about life after cycling, you know, a lot of guys don't, but I do. I look forward to it. Don't know when it'll be, but I look forward to it. I look forward to living a normal life, you know, and not leaving home every week to a different country and not living out of a suitcase. I look forward to being home for, you know, I don't know, Easter egg hunts with my kids, you know, you look forward to that. What I'll do, I don't know. I'm busy studying an accounting degree, so we'll see if I go into something finance or something along that way, or maybe I don't even use the degree I'm using. Maybe hopefully something else comes up before I have to retire. And I also don't want to prolong it, and I don't want to be 40 years old and still riding a bike, to be honest.
Iconic moments. You know, you've been around the block. You've mentioned all the countries you've raced in. You know, if you to think back to maybe 3 moments that really stand out, what would that be?
Winning the first stage of Tour Portugal in 2012 after being hit by a car 10 days before.
That's one.
That was definitely an iconic moment for me. Winning the Nationals definitely in 2013.
One more.
There's so many, but you have to think of one that's really good.
What do you think of when you go to bed at night? What's the cycling?
Finishing my first Roubaix. Even though I was out of time limit, finishing my first Roubaix was an iconic moment. I felt good after that. Was shit because you missed it. But you know, you have this DNF because you didn't finish in within a 5% rate of the winner. But actually riding every single section, getting through it, you know, priding yourself of riding, and I was so close to the time limit, they even let me on the velodrome. So you know, that was pretty awesome for me. You know, that was pretty iconic.
What about the worst moments? Or, like, is there a race where the bosses tell you you're racing and you just think, oh no. Worst moments or worst race?
Worst moment? I've had a few. One of my worst ones was leaving Tour of Rwanda in 2013. I got a stomach bug there, was in the yellow jersey by 2 minutes and couldn't even pedal myself out of the start. And, you know, I rode the neutral zone and did the first 15Ks and I was really 5 minutes behind. You know, that was a disappointing day for me. Crashing and breaking 6 ribs in my chest in Canada when I was leading the King of Mountains jersey by so many points that I needed one more point and I would have won the jersey. In 2008, I think that was. King of the Mountains for big guys. These are life goals.
Yeah, I get that. Right, okay, so I think the answer to this is yes, but do you still love it? Do you still love cycling?
I wouldn't do it if I didn't love it. I said that's the day I stopped. It was when I stopped enjoying 4 or 5 hour bike rides in -2 degrees. When I stopped enjoying that, yeah, of course you don't enjoy it, but you know, you don't have that love to actually want to get out on your bike and do it every single day. When I lose that love, then that's the day I'll stop.
Does it ever become just a job?
No, because then I've lost the love for it. It's still a passion. It's still everything I love.
Okay. Are you where you thought you would have been when you started out as like a 20-year-old kid?
Yes and no. Maybe I didn't think I would race at the biggest level when I was 20. But then also, you know, to be honest, yes and no. You know, when you're 20, cycling's changed so much in the last 14 years since I started. I wished and hoped one day I could ride at the biggest level in the world in cycling, but I didn't ever really believe it that I could. You know, so to actually have achieved it and got here and been riding here now for the last 6 years, it's pretty incredible, and I hope it lasts a few more, that I can keep on loving it and keep on doing it at this level.
One last question. What is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
Harden up, young man.
By who?
You know, I trained a lot with Robert Hunt, and this guy was really an idol for me when I grew up. So, you know, to train with him, and when I had to wake up at 4 in the morning to go meet him at 5 o'clock because he had to be home by 10 o'clock to do things with his kids. Yeah, it was pretty impressive. And, you know, he was always just train hard and just go. Just do it. Do what you have to do and go. And, you know, so from him, best advice I ever got was harden up.
Well, Jay, it's been fantastic talking to you. This has been my first podcast. This has been Cycling Mo, your cycling informant. I am the Cycling Mo. I am David Tunta. You have been Jay Thompson. Thank you very much for taking your time out to be on the podcast.
Only a pleasure. Thanks for having me for the first one. Strain the times change, flight delayed like haze. Thoughts looking like they foundation might cave. The look in my eyes resemble the ice age. The clocks of the crowd, the rent parkers wave park waves. Like moose saw, move raw. Involuntarily eat your full part. Feel like a painter who can't do wrong. Fallatio from lazy do fall to cocaine. But brought a broad brain with it all game. You snow change, you do like a sonic grand, probably 10. We push it in the hallway, all guard always. Yeah.